We are back with another episode of the Kyle Anzalone Show, and I have a ton to talk about today. The president keeps making threat after threat after threat on his Truth Social account. And of course, a lot of the threats recently have been directed towards Iran. And so there's a lot of reporting as to, is Trump going to attack the Islamic Republic? Isn't he? I am going to try to go through, break it all down so everybody understands what's going on, the public statements, what's happening behind the scenes. And so that's a big part of today's show is Iran. Also, I have some updates on Cuba, because that could be the site of Trump's next intervention. And so we have seen several times now, I have one of the posts here, but there's a good dozen or maybe two dozen since the end of last year of Donald Trump saying, we are threatening Iran, and if the Iranians don't do what we want, I have put a massive armada off their coast, and I am prepared to order an attack to overthrow the government of Iran. And so Trump has talked tough in the past on Truth Social. We've seen at times, say with Venezuela, when it comes to Maduro, Trump does follow through on those threats. We have seen other times, say with Greenland, where we ultimately see Trump end up backing down. And so with Iran, I think we really have to get into the weeds, get into everything going on to see if Trump is prepared to order an attack on the Islamic Republic. So I want to start off with this story. This is from Middle East Eye, published last week. U.S. weighs precision strikes on Iran, on Iranian officials as military buildup surges, sources say. And the article explains the U.S. is weighing precision strikes on high-value Iranian officials and commanders who deem responsible for the deaths of protesters, a Gulf official familiar with the discussions told Middle East Eye. And so we have seen a few of these reports now from various sources, Israeli sources, American sources, Arab sources, that Donald Trump wants to deliver a decisive attack in Iran. That seems to be the key word. And what decisive appears to mean is powerful enough that it will lead to the overthrow of the Iranian government. Now, it seems that from the reporting and all the details, that it's not necessarily they think the strike will fully overthrow the government, but it will create enough chaos and disorder in Tehran where street protesters can then come back out. And we know from the latest protests that there was a lot of foreign backing, U.S. involvement, particularly Israeli involvement from the Mossad, propping up their proxies in the MEK, that would like to try to seize power. And so it seems that one possibility is that. Another one, they're talking about partition. Iran is a country of 90 million people, and the majority, I think about 60%, are Persian. But there's also a substantial number of Azeris in Iran, including the supreme leader and the president. I think there's about a 10% population that is Kurdish. And just like in other areas of the Middle East, they're a little bit autonomous in Iran. And then, of course, you have different separatist groups that is this more along the Afghan and Pakistani border with Iran, and they are connected to terrorist organizations and things like that. And so there are people in the U.S. and I think in Israel as well, who would love to see nothing more than not just the overthrow of the Iranian government, but the destruction of the Iranian state, where you have factions of Azeris and Kurds and Persians vying for power, while you have these other jihadist groups kind of running around sowing chaos and killing people. Why would the U.S. and Israel want this? Because it means that Iran can no longer stand up to the United States, can no longer be a thorn in the American side. I mean, if you look at the war in Ukraine, for example, Iran has served as a trading partner for Russia. They've given Russian, at first just drones, and then access to drone technology that Russia has used heavily in Ukraine. Iran sells oil to China. And so for all these reasons, a destabilized Iran will be good for Israel and the United States. So I think we have a real fear that this is going to happen. Now, another kind of path that they're looking for is, this is from the Jerusalem Post. As U.S. forces build up, Trump weighs limited strikes to take Iran's regime. And the Jerusalem Post reports that the administration is examining the possibility of implementing a naval blockade on Iran that would prevent it from exporting oil. And they note that President Trump previously took a similar step against the Maduro regime in Venezuela, and a few weeks later launched an operation aimed at capturing President Maduro and his wife. And so look here, you know, you could kind of just see this all developing where Trump has basically two options, but the two options lead to the same result, the regime change in Iran. And so I think it's very clear that this is the goal in Washington and Tel Aviv. Now, the only question that they really have to answer, is it achievable and at what cost will it be achievable? I think there's a real risk for the Israelis and the Americans that they take a massive swipe at Iran. However, they put a lot of military assets in the region. And so Iran's going to have a lot of American and Israeli targets to fire at. And so if you take a massive shot at Iran, you're unable to overthrow the government. Iran uses their massive stockpile of ballistic cruise missiles and drones to batter U.S. bases around the Middle East, to batter Israel. Israel, a very small country, not just in terms of landmass, but also in population. A lot of the people that live in Israel are either immigrants themselves or, you know, first or second generation. It's a fairly new country. And so look, if, you know, drones and Iranian missiles are falling out of the skies at Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and Haifa, that may encourage a lot of Israelis to emigrate. And this could be a real problem for Tel Aviv. And so it's not as simple as just saying we're going to do this regime change. There actually has to be thought in Washington and Tel Aviv of if this, it's not like with Maduro, where if you unsuccessfully are unsuccessful in the operation against Maduro, some Americans who are on the ground may have been killed. American helicopter may be shot down over Venezuela. It's a nightmare public relations wise for Donald Trump, but it's not as if Venezuela is going to start lobbing drones and missiles into the United States or at U.S. bases in the region after that happens. But Iran has the capability to do it, and they said time and time again that they will do it. And so now the real question that we have to get into is Trump prepared? Does the U.S. have the military assets in the Middle East to do this? So this next article I have exclusive. U.S. military tells key Middle East allies to prepare for attack on Iran. And this is published at Dropsite News. And they have a quote from a former senior U.S. intelligence official who consults for Arab governments who said, "This isn't about nukes or the missile program. This is about regime change." And, you know, just making it very, very clear, really trying to drive it home. They say the thinking in the Trump administration, according to the source, is that a successful strike on the Iranian leadership will be followed by Iranians returning to the streets to protest, leading to an overthrow of the government. And so right there, laid out very clear that the U.S. government wants regime change in Iran. The next article I had, this one from the Wall Street Journal. Before any strike on Iran, U.S. needs to bolster air defenses in the Middle East. And so what the journal explains is that the U.S. military could conduct limited strikes on Iran if the president were to order attack today, U.S. officials say. But the kind of decisive attack that Trump has asked the military to prepare would likely prompt a proportional response from Iran, requiring the U.S. to have robust air defenses in place to protect Israel as well as U.S. troops. The military has air defenses in the region, including destroyers capable of shooting down threats, but the Pentagon is deploying additional THAAD batteries and Patriot air defense bases to where U.S. troops are stationed across the Middle East, including Jordan, Kuwait, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar. And so I think as we stand today, this is probably a sign the U.S. isn't fully prepared to launch a war with Iran. The idea that we still need to move Patriot and THAAD batteries all around the Middle East, to Kuwait, to Jordan, to Saudi Arabia, that's going to take a little bit of time. These are very complex systems. They require hundreds of troops to operate them. And so not only are you putting a lot more Americans in harm's way within range of Iranian missiles around the Middle East, and you have to kind of figure out the logistics of all of that, you also have to set up and deploy all these systems. So I don't think we are necessarily looking at imminent attack based on the current U.S. force posture in the Middle East, but you can see they are getting ready. Now, for people who say this is just all a show, this military buildup is just for Donald Trump to be able to threaten the Iranians, to be able to fearmonger and warn against the Iranians that, hey, these people are very dangerous, so we have all these troops in the region, and then he's going to demand the Iranians make all these concessions. The problem with that is this military buildup is very expensive, and it has now involved removing American military assets from other regions where they were going to be used. I think it was F-35s from the Vermont National Guard or some army division were moved from Latin America to the Middle East. Those F-35s may be used to bomb Iran, maybe used to shoot down Iranian drones coming back in. But you can see Donald Trump is starting to peel off military assets from other areas of the world where he's interested in using military power and deploying them to the Middle East. I really think this suggests that Trump isn't just bluffing. He isn't just playing around. There's reporting that inside the White House, there's a belief that the Iranian regime could potentially fall very soon. And really, the debate is just around how to go about this. You have some factions, I think this is more Steve Witkoff, the Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, who are arguing that the Iranian economy is really weak. The people are ready to rise up and overthrow the Iranian government. And so the U.S. just needs to a little bit of a push to topple it over, and that could be the oil blockade. There are others, and this includes really shockingly and disappointingly Vice President J.D. Vance, who are arguing to Trump, the Iranian regime is weak. You've already made threats and you have to follow through on those threats. So this is all just highly, highly concerning. Now, I do want to go back to that Drop Site News article now, the one we were referencing earlier. And they add in that article that senior military officials have informed the leadership of a key U.S. ally in the Middle East that President Trump could authorize a strike on Iran this weekend. So that would have been Saturday or Sunday. And of course, that didn't happen. But just to know, it does seem that the White House is putting out signals to the Middle East, to our allies, to, hey, Trump could order an attack at any time. Now, this is where I think the most reasonable timeline is. This article from the New Arab, Israeli Army Chief predicts U.S. attack on Iran within 2 weeks to 2 months. And so this is IDF Chief of Staff Amal Zamir. And he was just at the Pentagon, by the way, just on Friday, I believe. Him and some other top Israeli officials were at the Pentagon. And he said that a U.S. attack on Iran within a time frame ranging from 2 weeks to 2 months. And he said that to Israel Army Radio. And he says that this means that imminent attack in the coming days is unlikely, but not impossible, but unlikely. And I do think that assessment is right based on the U.S. trying to get more military assets to the Middle East. I think they have 8 destroyers now within CENTCOM's range. So this is those that are a part of the USS Abraham Lincoln Aircraft Carrier Strike Group, plus a few more. Each one of these ships could carry a lot of interceptors, and that, I think, is the big thing right now. Trump may favor using B-2s and other heavy bombers, as well as like attack submarines launching Tomahawk and other missiles at Iran as far as offensive attacks go, while a lot of these military assets that we're talking about moving to the Middle East right now, the THAAD interceptors, the Patriot interceptors, the warships, the fighter jets are all about shooting down incoming Iranian drones and missiles, protecting U.S. and Israeli forces from Iranian retaliation. This should be a big warning sign to Americans, by the way, about how dangerous this war is going to be for U.S. troops in the Middle East, that the U.S. is deploying so many military assets to the Middle East to protect our troops that are already there, it, you know, is a big sign that they are expecting missiles and drones to be raining down and risking the lives of U.S. soldiers. Now, the other kind of paradoxical part about this military buildup is Iran doesn't maintain weapons that could actually strike the United States of America. And so Iran doesn't actually threaten the United States. But if we go to war with Iran, Iran will strike at American military assets in the region. And we've added probably tens of thousands of more soldiers now. They're all within the range of Iranian drones and missiles because of this military buildup. There's 5,000 to 6,000 sailors on the Abraham Lincoln. Each destroyer is another 300 to 350 sailors. Each THAAD battery is 100 soldiers, dozens for each Patriot battery. All the fighter pilots and support soldiers to operate the fighter jets that we've deployed to the Middle East now are all in harm's way if Donald Trump starts a war. And so again, in that sense, this is all very paradoxical. Now, to maybe shine a little bit of optimism on the situation, this is the best argument I've heard for why we might not see a U.S. strike on Iran. This is John Kerouac discussing the potential for a U.S. strike on Iran with his co-host Ted Rall on their podcast Deprogrammed.
The Fed's out of options. Rate cuts, money printing, balance sheet reversals. They call it policy, but it's really panic. This is in-game economics, where hope replaces discipline and the illusion of control finally breaks. They're not cutting rates because things are strong. They're cutting because the system is cracking. Inflation's eating savings. The labor market's stalling. Confidence in the dollar is fading fast. For decades, the Fed built a house of paper. Now they're striking the match that could burn it all down, leaving you to pay the price. When's the last time you actually held the wealth you've spent your life working for? My friends at Noble Gold Investments have been helping Americans move from paper wealth into real tangible assets. Numbers on a screen can disappear, but physical gold and silver, they've outlasted every crisis in history. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and get your free wealth protection kit today. That's NobleGoldInvestments.com for your free wealth protection kit. Discover how simple it is to protect your future.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
Okay. So I actually don't have that, but what John Kerouac explains is that, he spoke with several well-placed Arab princes. So these are people that John Kerouac has met, developed relationships with in recent weeks. And they told him that not only were all the Gulf Arab states lobbying Trump against going to war against Iran, which you know, may have some impact, right? These states like Qatar and Saudi Arabia, they invest a lot of money in Trump and Kushner and Witkoff's companies. And so certainly they do have some influence in Washington. However, all the influence is really piled up with the Israel lobby. And the question is, does the Israel lobby want war with Iran? And John's point and what he heard these princes say was that they don't want war with Iran right now. During the 12-day war in June, Israel used a substantial portion of its missile interceptors, its Iron Dome, and its Arrow interceptors. And those take years and years and years to replenish. And so by now, they've replenished some of them, but they still don't have enough. If you remember at the end of the 12-day war, after only 12 days, 7-8 days, a week of this war, Israel was already complaining that, hey, we're having to ration out our air defense systems. We can't just cover the country in blanket and make sure no Iranian missiles or drones are getting through. We have to be selective at how we fire these interceptors. And if this is a bigger conflict, which I do believe it would be, Israel would need more interceptors than they had previously, not less. And so if they don't have their stockpiles full, which they do not, then maybe even Israel is lobbying against an attack at this point. So To add a little bit of credibility to this, this was an article from Axios kind of breaking down last month when Donald Trump was considering striking Iran and decided not to. The title, "The Order Never Came, Behind the Scenes of Trump's Iran Pullback," and what they explained. In a call earlier in the day, one surprising voice urged caution: Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He told Trump that Israel was not ready to defend itself from Iran's likely retaliation, especially since the U.S. didn't have enough assets in the region to help Israel intercept Iranian missiles and drones. In addition, Netanyahu felt the current U.S. plan was not strong enough and would not be effective, one of the prime minister's advisors said. And so this is all, I think, possible that this has been resolved now. It's possible that Netanyahu now feels with the additional THAAD Patriot interceptors, a few more destroyers, a few more U.S. Warplanes in the Middle East, that the U.S. is now in a position to at least acceptably defend Israel from Iranian retaliation. Look, Netanyahu is a cold son of a bitch. And so I do think he would be willing to have some Israeli civilians die in a war with Iran if he thought it was going to substantially and permanently weaken Iran in the Middle East, right? So if Netanyahu believes that a war will lead to the fracturing of the Islamic, Iranian government or of the Iranian state, or at least the overthrow of the Islamic Revolutionary Government of Iran, and that came at the lives of hundreds or thousands of Israelis, Netanyahu would probably pull the trigger on that. But as I said before, Israel is a small country, not a big population, and they have a real risk of emigration, people going back to the countries that either they came from or that their parents or grandparents are from if things get a little too hot in Israel. So he has to kind of weigh that. And you know, if he now considers there being enough interceptors of the U.S. and Israel in the Middle East to go ahead and launch that war, I think he'll lobby to Trump to launch the war. If he doesn't think that they're adequately equipped to defend against an Iranian attack, then he will advocate against it. I think Trump is probably at least so split right now that he's willing to let Netanyahu tip him in either direction. And I worry that Netanyahu is going to advocate for war, especially because the larger U.S. military footprint in the Middle East now will enable the U.S. to deliver a much larger strike against Iran. And even if it doesn't overthrow the Iranian government, my guess is that the hubris in Tel Aviv and Washington will make them think the operation will likely be successful. Now, there is another development that we've had today that may signal that a war is not coming, or it may be a signal that a war is coming, looking at history. So this is from Ynet News. Ahead of talks, Israel sets red lines for Trump's envoy, Witkoff. And so what we heard today is that Steve Witkoff, apparently there's been back channel developed with Turkey. Witkoff is Trump's main envoy, by the way. And this Turkish back channel is trying to negotiate between the Iranians and the Americans. Now, I don't know how well positioned Turkey is to be the intermediary here. In the past, Russia, China, the Omanis have served as kind of far more productive arbiters of conflicts between the U.S. and Iran. And additionally, you know, Erdogan, the leader of Turkey, is always out for something. Like, he is a very strong nationalist. I think he has grand ambitions, including expanding Turkey's borders. And so I'm not sure the Iranians would necessarily trust the Turks to broker these talks. And Turkey has even talked about setting up like a joint nuclear enrichment program with Iran that was based in Turkey. So they certainly have their own interests and motives here. And I wouldn't, if I were the Iranians, I'd be very skeptical. But there are some reports that the U.S. and the Iranians could sit down as soon as Friday. Now, Axios was, I believe, the outlet that broke this story. And they had two sources that said it was going to happen on Friday and one source that said it may or may not. Now, I want to get into one very key thing here, and this is in the Ynet article. So Israel has informed the U.S. that there are red lines on the nuclear issue, including demand for zero enrichment and the removal of Iranian uranium from Iranian territory. But the main concern is that the Americans may ultimately settle for an agreement addressing only the nuclear issue while sidelining to others, Iran's ballistic missiles, and its campaign of terror and support for proxy forces. And so there's a lot in this YNET thing. First of all, the audacity of the Israelis to come in between U.S. and Iranian negotiations and tell the Americans what our red lines are. That's not how this works. You know, the Israelis could express their interest to American officials, and we could take those into consideration along with the Saudis and the Qataris and the Emiratis and the Turks and the Iraqis. Sure, that's very reasonable. But the idea that the Israelis would not only feel comfortable influencing and directing American negotiating with the Iranians, but actually setting red lines for the Americans is completely intolerable. And we should all be 100% opposed to that. This is America's foreign policy. How we choose to deal with the Iranians is up to us. And the Israelis don't get to dictate the terms that we negotiate to the Iranians on. And this is important because the Israeli terms are completely unacceptable. They amount to far more than a full surrender, right? If Russia was trying to impose these terms on the Ukrainians, people in America would be absolutely outraged, right? Not only are they demanding that Iran not enrich uranium, they're demanding that Iran export all of its uranium. They're demanding that Iran not have alliances and ties with other groups in their own region, right? They're demanding that Iran not have a missile program that could hit Israel. That way, anytime Israel wants, they could bomb Iran without fear of retaliation whatsoever. Obviously, the Iranians aren't going to agree to this, and so the Israelis are trying to kill the talks. Now, when I first brought up this story, I said this could be a sign that we're not going to see a war, or it could be a sign that we're going to see a war. It's really important to remember that in June, the U.S. and Iran, according to the Iranians, were moving full steam ahead, progressing towards the new nuclear deal, and then suddenly the Israelis started bombing Iran. And so maybe this is a legitimate U.S. outreach for diplomacy with the Iranians, or it's possible that this is cover for the U.S. or Israel to start another war on Iran. Now, if that does happen, the Iranian foreign minister had some words of warning to the Americans. So let's roll this clip.
It starts. That would be a disaster for everybody. In the previous war, we tried hard to limit the scope of war between Iran and Israel. This time, if it is between Iran and the U.S., since the U.S. bases are spread all over the region, then inevitably, many parts of the region would be involved, engaged, and that could be very dangerous. Our missiles were tested in a real war last time, and we were able to, understand their problems, their weak points, and their strengths. So we learned many lessons from those 12 days of war, and I think we are now very well prepared. But again, being prepared doesn't mean that we want war. We want to prevent a war.
So I think this just really highlights the one last important point that I want to make here. And if the U.S. goes ahead and attacks Iran, it could very lead to a Middle East-wide war. If the U.S. attacks Iran, Iran will respond, and probably not just symbolically this time, by attacking U.S. bases in the Middle East. Those bases are in Iraq, they're in Syria, they're in Jordan, they're in Israel, they're in Saudi Arabia, they're in Qatar, they're in Bahrain, they're in Kuwait. These are all additional countries that could very quickly be drugged into this conflict. And of course, it's not going to be the entire Middle East, Israel and the United States against Iran. Iran has allies in the Middle East, right? If the Iraqi government starts to back and assist the U.S. in striking Iran, then the Shia militias in Iraq, which are probably more loyal to Tehran than they are to Baghdad, may turn on the Iraqi government. We could see a new civil war in Iraq. Hezbollah in southern Lebanon could go back to war, whether that's with the Syrian government, whether that's with the Israeli government. And of course, the Houthis in Yemen, Ansar Allah, have shown to be very effective fighters and very capable of creating a lot of problems for the U.S. and Israel so far. But when you consider something like where Yemen is positioned in the Middle East compared to Iran, say, the Houthis, if they're launching drones at U.S. bases in Saudi Arabia and in Qatar, they're coming at a whole nother direction than the Iranian attacks would be, which is going to stretch air defenses and radars a whole lot more and create a real nightmare for the Americans and the Israelis should this war go forward. I think it's going to be a real catastrophe. I am very worried that Donald Trump has decided on attacking Iran, and basically it's now just a matter of gaining enough military assets into the Middle East to be confident a large number of American troops and Israelis won't be killed in the Iranian retaliatory attack. But who knows how messy this gets once they move forward with regime change in Iran. And by the way, I think the best option here, the best scenario, is that Trump elects for the oil blockade, which will probably end up escalating into a war over the longer term. Now, it's not just the Iranians receiving threats from Donald Trump. He is still threatening countries within our own region, and that includes the Cubans. I got a couple posts here of Trump's recent threats towards Cuba, basically saying that the Cuban government is ready to fall. And this next one is even more audacious. He actually suggests that Marco Rubio will make a good president of Cuba, which, I mean, if we're going to deport Marco Rubio and impose him on the poor Cubans, I guess, as somebody who really just cares about his country first, I would be fine with that. But that's not the way it'll actually work. He'll still be the Secretary of State and National Security Advisor and just the viceroy leader of Cuba. I think Donald Trump is actually, I don't know how much Donald Trump personally cares about regime change in Cuba, but I do think he's convinced on a couple of points here. One, because Donald Trump is located in South Florida, where there are a lot of Hispanics who have been in the U.S. for quite some time, them, their children are all citizens. Many of them have done very well in this country. They're entrepreneurs, business owners, successful members of their community. I think Donald Trump believes that they reflect the sentiment of Hispanics in the United States of America. And I don't think that's really the case. A lot of people are first generation. They're living here illegally, or they have family members who are living here illegally. They're poor. And so when ICE is cracking down, it's not the Cubans and the Venezuelans in Miami and in South Florida who are the ones who are against that policy. It's the Mexicans, the Salvadorians, the Haitians in the United States who are being rounded up by ICE. And then that's a far greater population. So I do think Donald Trump believes that if he meddles in Venezuela, if he takes out the Cuban government, the Hispanics of the United States are going to suck up the fact that he's been rounding up their family members brutally through the ICE program, the ICE arrest, and, you know, react favorably to him and Republicans. I don't think that gambit is going to work, but I do think Donald Trump believes that it will. And then, of course, Donald Trump isn't very strong on any of his beliefs when it comes to foreign policy, and somebody like Marco Rubio is. He really, really, really wants regime change in Latin America, in Latin American countries, primarily Cuba. I think if you look at kind of the development of U.S. policy in the Middle East, and we see this in a recent Wall Street Journal article, the U.S. is actively seeking regime change in Cuba by the end of the year. They say, emboldened by the U.S. ouster of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, the Trump administration is searching the Cuban government for insiders who can help cut a deal to push out the communist government by the end of the year. And so what they're doing is they're trying to isolate the Cuban government from Venezuela. They've pressured the Mexican government to cut off Mexican oil sales to Cuba. So they're trying to create absolute poverty, absolute misery in Cuba, and then find some people who are willing to go and overthrow the government. I think that's Trump's plan at this point. I think we could see how a lot of his other middle Latin American interventions are really all centered around Cuba. Now, Trump has had some remarks on Cuba in the past few days, so I want to play a few clips. Let's start with this first one.
What do you want to see from Cuba? I mean, what do you need to see to make that kind of deal?
I think we're going to work a deal with Cuba. I think, you know, we'll be kind. We have a situation that's very bad for Cuba. They have no money. They have no oil. Venezuela, they live off Venezuelan money and oil. And none of that's coming now. And then the president of Mexico, President Chavez, was very good. I said, look, we don't want you sending oil there. Then she's not sending oil.
So what Trump's saying there is that he believes that the people within his government believe the Cuban government's in a weakened position because they've been cut off from other countries in the region, and it's ripe for an overthrow, an American regime change. While it's possible that that is the case, we've also seen the Cuban government being able to weather very hard situations and maintain control, even when poverty was very, very, very severe in Cuba, particularly after fall of the USSR. So just, you know, they always get these rosy predictions about how effective sanctions are going to be. It was going to cripple the Russian war machine. It was going to bring down the Iranian government. Cuba has been under an American embargo for 6 or 7 decades now, and it hasn't caused the fall of that government. In fact, there's a lot of evidence that points to these American sanctions actually create a rally around the flag effect in those countries. And while these leaders may have incompetently ran their economies into the ground, the fact that the leaders could also point to the U.S. sanctions as contributing to it deflects a lot of the blame. All right, next Trump clip.
Out of a Cuba deal.
Well, Cuba's a failing nation. It has been for a long time, but now it doesn't have Venezuela to prop it up. So we're talking to the people from Cuba, the highest people in Cuba, to see what happens. I want the people that came here that were horribly treated by Cuba to be taken care of, to be able to go back and do what they have to do. You know, they have their family there. They haven't been able to see them in years, many, many years. So I think we're going to make a deal with Cuba.
So I think we're seeing Trump believe that he's going to be able to replicate what happened in Venezuela and Cuba. We're talking to high people there. You know, I think he's talking about government officials who may be below the top level who are willing to cut a deal with the United States to have the leader of that country and any loyalists who won't bend to U.S. whims shipped out, and then we'll install a new government in power. Of course, in Venezuela, it remains to be seen if this is actually going to be in any way a successful policy, but the Trump administration, Donald Trump, seems to be looking to replicate in Cuba. I got one last clip here before we wrap up.
We need to talk to Cuba, yeah? We're starting to talk to Cuba.
If they need help on a humanitarian basis, we're starting to talk to Cuba. Don't forget, a lot of people that live in our country are treated very badly by Cuba. And we want them to be, they all voted for me, and we want them to be treated well. We'd like to be able to have them go back to a home to their country, which they haven't seen their family, their country, for many, many decades. So we'll work that. I'll be able to work that out.
So I just want to highlight one last time here how cruel this policy is. What they are trying, there's already poverty in Cuba. There's already rolling blackouts. The people there are already suffering, but Donald Trump wants to make it even worse. He believes economic misery among the Cuban people will weaken their government and create a better situation for the United States of America and Cuba. It's unbelievably awful to do that to an entire population of people who are just trying to live their lives. They have a government that doesn't agree with ours, but so what? The Cubans don't present any threat to the United States of America. In fact, probably the most serious threat that Cuba presents the United States of America is an economic collapse leading to a mass wave of migrants arriving in South Florida again. That is like the worst possible scenario that could come for the United States, the people of the United States from Cuba. And that seems to be the one that Donald Trump is angling to create here, all because Marco Rubio wants regime change in Havana. It's absolutely disgusting. Everybody, thank you for checking out the show today. I did see the chat was a little slow, so if you are still listening, let us know that you're here. Be sure you're subscribed to the show, that you're following the show. We're always live on ads and on YouTube every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday at 4:45 Eastern, and we'll be back with another show on Wednesday. Thanks, everyone.